This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
You learn from your mistakes. That's a little nugget of wisdom that's been passed down through the years and has the advantage of being true, at least according to children's author Barney Salzberg.
So many things that we take for granted now, whether it's a Post-it or a scotch guard or a chocolate chip cookie, were all discoveries from mistakes.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about Salzberg's book, Celebrating the Well-Placed Mistake, Beautiful Oops. We'll also celebrate the 65th anniversary of the best-selling children's books ever, The Little Golden Books. And we'll spend an academic minute with some young puzzlers. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Hooray for mistakes! That's the first line of the press release for children's author Barney Salzberg's new book. He says if you spill some juice on a paper, turn that stain into a cloud or a monster. It's never too early to learn how to turn your mistakes into an advantage. Or as he says in the book, Beautiful Oops, a smudge and a smear can make magic appear. We spoke with Barney Salzberg recently and asked what age group he was aiming for when he wrote Beautiful Oops.
All ages. All ages. I actually didn't know until the book came out. Well, they wrote three and up and up and up on it. But I was at a wonderful bookstore in California where there was 150 teachers and librarians. And the woman who was introducing me said, this is a book for someone graduating college, and it's a book for someone starting preschool. I'm a big believer that picture books are really for all ages, even though they seem like they're young stories. And this book really is, I'm hoping, a book for all ages. And some stores actually have it in the adult art sections. So I'm not alone in that thought.
Your children are grown or in college. Do you have some young people in your family or in your life that this book was written for?
Well, I do have nieces and nephews. They're getting pretty big, too. But this really was born from my traveling around the country. I speak to educators and children about the creative process, and I have a PowerPoint presentation that I give, and two of the images have stuck out to teachers who have consistently said to me, can you show this in a book? And one was a page where my dog actually got locked in my office and stepped on a piece of finished art, and I show the kids what it looked like with paw prints all over it, and I was devastated that I had to start over. And when I took a breath and looked at that picture again, I realized I could make each paw print into a cloud. So I always say that dog helped me compose that piece. And I also have a sketchbook where I spilled coffee on the cover of it. And I always ask kids, how many of you would want a new one if you had a stain like this? And they all raised their hands. I took that stain when it dried and drew a monster in the shape. So those two prompted teachers to say, this is something we'd love to get across. And I didn't know how to really integrate it into a story. I didn't want to have a story that was a lesson, per se. And one day I was in my studio and I tore a piece of paper partway across, and the second I saw it, I went, that looks like a mouth of an alligator. It had the rough ridges, and so when I flipped the page over, I painted an alligator on it. And I thought, if I just continue on this path and think about all the potential mistakes I could make, I bet I could do a book. And that's really how it happened.
That approach goes against what most of society thinks now, where things are, you know, disposable and replaceable.
No question. And although if you saw my studio, you'd know I don't throw many things out. But it's also along the same lines is the concept that so many things that we take for granted now, whether it's a Post-it or a scotch guard or a chocolate chip cookie, were all discoveries for mistakes. And it's a concept that in education, we are in a test-oriented society right now where you need to study for a test and get the right answer, and anything that's wrong is a mistake. And it's negating a whole process of the educational system, which is discovering something. And sometimes that discovery, most discoveries are things that were unexpected, and to keep an open mind. And I think it's a liberating concept. I'm talking to adults who have seen this book and are saying, I need to really kind of think about this again, because they have just kind of written off any mistake as wrong, as opposed to maybe I can turn that into something that's unexpected and better than I was originally shooting for.
So it is important to learn from your mistakes.
Yes.
Do you think some parents want their kids to be too perfect?
I think it's self-imposed as well, but definitely some parents. I did have one child who is now an adult say when she was a kid, this book would have been her worst nightmare because she was such a perfectionist. Her mom was always saying, don't worry about it, but she actually put it upon herself. And I think people are hard on themselves. You know, I see it developmentally when a kid's about in the fourth grade and they start recognizing that their drawings don't look like they want them to. And a lot of kids give up. They just stop. And I'm always pulling out a pen and a piece of paper when I'm in a restaurant and getting people to make squiggles with me. And we flip them around and look at them and try to turn them into things. And it's really something that I've always done. But I'm finding that people who have stopped drawing start getting turned on by the process again. And this book just kind of pushes that concept into all different arenas because it's not just drawing.
Do you travel around and do many classroom visits?
Every year is different. Budgets are tighter right now given the economy, but I do travel around and speak at schools and at conferences for teachers and see kids. Yeah, I do get out.
And you teach one class a year, right?
Yes, once a year I teach a class at UCLA on writing and illustrating picture books. And that's adults of all ages take that class. It's pretty fascinating to see. The people who take the class are a wide range of backgrounds. It could be in L.A. We have, you know, animators. It could be I've had a number of therapists, a number of teachers. I had a retired pediatric surgeon once do it. It's all walks of life. I think a lot of people have a special spot for kids' books, and most of us think it's easy to do. So they just kind of think, I'll just take this class and become a rich author. And it's always fun to see how that unfolds.
Have you noticed a change in those students over the years?
The students are pretty much the same. I think this semester is really, because of digital books, everybody's kind of wondering what the impact's going to be for picture books. It's much different to translate a novel into a digital format. But every picture book's different. There's no cookie-cutter stamp, boilerplate stamp, that you can just say, every book's going to do this. So it becomes a much costlier process to convert a book, and no one really knows how they're going to be. So I'm seeing my students are coming in with questions. You know, are there going to be picture books? And if so, how are they going to be? And we don't know yet.
It would be odd trying to translate a book like this into the digital format, it being about, you know, mistakes and everything, where, you know, mistakes can just be deleted and fixed.
Yeah, it I can see it happening that way, and I know that anybody born after 1980 is completely comfortable using a screen for pretty much everything. I will miss the tactile part of the process to hold this book. I love the feel of the paper. That would be missing. I think at some point this book will look like a tin toy, but right now it's cutting edge.
Well, I mean, it's a nice heavy book, thick paper. It's just about, you know, indestructible for kids.
Yeah, I was really happy that they did that because you do see these books get shredded usually. But Workman really does a wonderful job, and they made this book look better than I could have ever imagined. And the paper's great.
You sound like someone who's really comfortable in front of a classroom. You must have some great stories and some great memories of some things that students have done in your classes.
I had a student recently, apparently I overheard the teacher say that this girl told a class that her father was in the Beatles. And I had a kind of, I talk about the Beatles in my PowerPoints. That's a whole other story. I won't go there. It was. I saved her. I don't want to out her in front of her friends that her dad wasn't really in the Beatles. It's been fun to show this book. The first time a kid saw it and saw that the first page had a tear in it, their eyes widened because they actually thought the book was torn, and it wasn't supposed to be. They got very nervous about it until they turned the page and saw that it was in fact supposed to be in there. It reminds me of being a kid going to the statue. We were in Philadelphia. My father bought me a Liberty Bell, a little toy one, as a memento. And I was five, and I looked at my dad and said, it's got a crack in it. Can we get another one? I then learned what the Liberty Bell was.
And it can't hurt to have a quote from Jamie Lee Curtis right on your cover.
You know, I was pretty blown away that she responded the way she did to the book. And offer to write something as beautiful as she did. It was a nice vote of confidence.
And she's a children's author herself.
And a good one. So I don't take her comments lightly. She really means a lot to me. I think she's pretty much the best movie star out there doing children's books. So for her to comment the way she did on my book means a lot.
Again, the name of Barney Salzberg's book is Beautiful Oops. It's published by Workman. Still to come, when talking about children's books, the conversation has to begin with the classic Little Golden Books. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1140. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. For 65 years, the classic Little Golden Books have been the gateway to millions of young readers into the world of literature and education. The Best of Our Knowledge's Katie Britton talks about the history of the Little Golden Books with author and historian Leonard Marcus.
It's a happy golden day.
The Little Golden Books have been a part of our lives for generations. We would know the Golden Blackspine anywhere, and favorites like The Sailor Dog, The Little Critter Books, and Richard Scarry's Bunny Books have been captivating children for decades. The number one golden book, and children's book for that matter, of all time, The Pokey Little Puppy, which was also one of the original 12 Little Golden Books. So to celebrate the Little Golden Book's 65th anniversary, children's book historian Leonard Marcus wrote Golden Legacy and explains how Golden Books won children's hearts, changed publishing, and became an American icon along the way.
Golden Books were much less expensive than other picture books by far, and the people who started that enterprise wanted to democratize book publishing for children. They didn't want parents to have to spend a lot of money or be living in a big city because most small towns didn't even have a bookstore. So they found a way to print good quality but inexpensive picture books that could be sold in places like drugstores and five and dimes and eventually even supermarkets.
How were they received by the public?
Phenomenally well. The traditional bookstores were afraid of them, partly because they looked kind of down market compared to what was being done at that time. And they also were so inexpensive that the stores stood to make almost no profit from them. So there was a snob element, and there was also, you know, a commercial resistance to them. But parents would find them in places like Woolworth's, and they realized that at a quarter apiece, you know, they could afford to buy a few in the hope that at least one of them would work well at home. You know, and this was happening just as World War II was starting in 1942. And lots of fathers were going off to the war. Mothers were left with young children at home. And Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady, was, you know, writing a column with advice for parents, well, for everyone. But one of the things that she frequently said in her column was, read to your children at night to keep them calm and to show them that life will go on. So Golden Books were the perfect response to that urging that she made to the American public.
So they had a huge effect on society then.
Oh, yeah. And some of the people who were involved in making the books had child psychology backgrounds. You know, they understood what some of the basic things that children care about are. Like, what does it mean to have, you know, a baby arrive in your household if you're 4 or 5 years old? Or what is your first day of school going to be like? Or what's it going to be like to get your appendix out? There were a lot of books that focused on the everyday experiences of young children. And then there were others that were retellings of fairy tales, you know, once upon a time stories. Some were funny, some were, you know, more in the nature of dramatic and wild and epic adventures. So there was a big range, and that was also part of the point. You'd go into the store and you'd take one of this and one of that and bring it all home.
Am I incorrect in saying that many of the first books were written by Western Publishing and Simon & Schuster employees and not real authors?
Right. Well, I mean, some of them were real authors who happened to be working for a publishing company. But yeah, they were very focused on the pictures as what would catch the parents' eye when they walked into the story. So they would generate ideas, and they were like an idea factory for children's books. And very often, staff people would write them, and then they would figure out which of the stable, very talented illustrators they had at their disposal would be the best person. But they also got Margaret Weiss Brown, best known as the author of Goodnight Moon, to write a number of Golden books. And she was, you know, one of the biggest stars in the whole firmament of children's literature at that time. And they got some of the people who were teaching at the Bank Street College of Education to write books, because they assumed that those people would have a deep understanding of the psychology and the needs and interests of young children. And Bank Street happened to be a place that was running a workshop for writers for children, so they were really keyed into that kind of writing anyway.
The illustration platform was interesting, too. First was the palette of colors the illustrators were able to use.
Uh-huh. Well, there two companies came together to create Golden Books. One was Simon & Schuster, which was a kind of maverick young publishing company at the time. They were interested in doing risky, unusual things, including making books so expensive that everybody in America could afford them. And the other partner was a printing company based in the Midwest. They had giant color printing presses, and that was one of the ways that they kept the price of the Golden Books down. They had the economies of scale that came from producing the books on these giant presses that ran 24 hours a day. So at a time when printing in color was an expensive proposition for most traditional publishers, Golden was in a position to say to illustrators, you know, you can basically use all the color you want. And that, of course, in turn made the books more saleable and helped to justify the huge print runs that they did.
The illustrators themselves were an eclectic group.
Yeah, some of them were exiles from Europe, people who fled because of the beginning of World War II. Some were, as I like to say, animators who fled from Walt Disney because he, you know, in the 30s had created a studio in order to make his big feature film, starting with Snow White in the late 1930s. So he had this big talent pool. And a number of those artists decided at a certain point in their careers that they wanted to be more independent, not part of a team. They wanted to have their name on their work, which didn't typically happen with Disney in a big way. So they came east after World War II, and many of them ended up illustrating Golden Books. Gustav Tengren, who illustrated The Pokey Little Puppy, was the leader of that group, really. He was the oldest and the first to come. Mary Blair, who was a major figure of the Disney studio, began doing Golden Books in the 50s, and there were several others. And then there were a number of illustrators who can't be classified in that way. One of the best known would be Eloise Wilkin, who also designed dolls, which were extremely popular in America, one called Baby Doll. And one of the great sort of funny stories that I encountered in doing my research was that when Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, came to the United Nations to bang his shoe on the desk in front of the world television cameras to threaten the West, you know, with extinction, he and his entourage left the UN and went over to the toy store FAO Schwartz and bought 13 of these baby dolls to bring home to their grandchildren. And then the other really famous illustrator who came from neither of those camps, neither the European exiles or the Disney exiles, was Richard Scarry. And he came along in the late 1940s, the son of a Boston department store owner who had chosen to rebel, you know, against, enter the family business, and, you know, instead turned out to be one of the most popular picture book artists of all time.
Richard Scarry's books were always my favorite out of them.
Yeah, and, you know, he had a very interesting career, both in the sense that he knew how to touch children, how to engage their curiosity on a, you know, on a global scale. At one time, his books were more popular than Dr. Seuss's books all around the world. But he never got prizes. He never won the Caldecott Medal. And I think it has something to do with the fact that his books, you know, he even used the word busy in the title of some of his books. They were very busy art, not the kind of art that you would expect to see on the wall of a museum. And yet children love to get lost in those mazes of little details that he filled his picture spaces with. And it turns out that progressive educators loved what he did too, because as in the case of his very most popular book, Richard Scarry's best word book ever, he organized information topically, so he created opportunities for children to think about how different objects in their everyday world relate to each other. So it was the opposite of rote thinking. It was about relationship thinking.
So you mentioned all the Disney exiles, but Disney was brought into the picture for the Golden Books.
That's true, yeah. Way, way back in what might be called the prehistory of Golden Books, because before the Western Printing Company became a partner in Golden Books in the early 40s, they were already doing some other children's books. And the best known of those was a series called the Big Little Books, which were sort of chunky size books that fit in the palm of a child's hand, and they were compilations of comic strip stories. And early on, Western approached Disney, who was then really brand new on the scene. He had just created the character of Mickey Mouse, about having the exclusive license to Disney characters for children's books. And they struck a deal, and from then on, from the early 30s on into the 80s, Western and then the Golden Books imprint became the exclusive publisher of Disney-related children's books. Disney was a perfectionist, so he never had enough cash on hand because he was always putting his money back into making his animations better. So in the 50s, when he wanted to build Disneyland, he was again short of cash, and he turned to the Golden Books people to help him fund it. So they had this sort of background or hidden relationship with Disney for many, many years.
The name of Leonard Marcus's book is Golden Legacy, How Golden Books Won Children's Hearts, Changed Publishing Forever, and Became an American Icon Along the Way. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Katie Britton. Reading is a great way to begin a child's education, but so is doing puzzles. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Completing puzzles can be a challenging and relaxing way to spend time, but as Susan Levine, professor and co-director of the Center for Early Childhood Research at the University of Chicago, explains, the practice helps toddlers build important skills with far-reaching benefits.
Maybe this has happened to you. A toddler you know or are caring for reaches for a puzzle and the two of you put it together. You might suggest that she look for a corner piece or put the pieces with the straight edges together. Suddenly, an image of a bird or a farm animal shows up, and the puzzle pieces begin to form a hole where the edges meet. Putting a puzzle together is not only fun, but also a serious piece of work for the toddler. That's what we are finding in our early childhood research. Children who play with puzzles developed a better understanding of spatial relationships, how things fit together, and how shapes can be combined to form new images. We found this out when we videotaped children interacting with their parents during everyday activities. We didn't tell the parents what to do. We just told them to interact with their children the way they normally would. Some of them played with puzzles and some of them didn't. When we assessed the child later, we found out that those who played with puzzles between the ages of 2 and 4 years had better spatial thinking skills at kindergarten entry. That gives them a leg up on later learning for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, what we call the STEM disciplines. We also found that just talking to children about spatial relationships, such as shape terms or spatial dimensions like tall, short, or spatial features such as curved, straight edges, predicts their later spatial and numerical skills. So have fun playing puzzles with your toddler. You can get them ready for school at the same time.
That was Susan Levine of the University of Chicago. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.